time. It's an incredible time of year, and it's come up so quick. Seems like I know myself, I've been so busy here in the sense I would say it really began to heat up from the 1st of August, and it's been kind of go, go, go on trying to get things together. I'm going to let you in on it. Well, I probably shouldn't, but maybe I will anyhow, because it came to my mind. That's why I thought I might. You see all these nice, beautiful plants back here? We like flowers in this church area and plants. Now, in the past, we've rented them, but this year, we bought them. Why? Well, because it was cheaper to buy them than to rent them. So we have a problem. What are we going to do with them when the feast is over? Does anybody have a garden? It'll be first come, first serve. Well, you have some very nice plants back here. And we will, until the feast is over, we're going to guard them with our life. So the people that did the flowers, I had to do it this year because everybody was gone. It's actually been kind of interesting doing that. I went down to the florist where we have got them in the past, and I went in there and told them what we were doing and what I needed. And so this lady and I went walking out all through this nursery, and I started looking, well, what looks good here? You know, well, I'll take some of those, and we'll take some of those, and and that's how it came about. And but the nice, beautiful bouquet here in the front is from a different florist, and we go to this particular one every year. She does a great job, and we love the beauty of it. So a lot of people have put a lot of work into it, and it's very, very beautiful, and appreciate that very much. Now I better get going because I told the guys that they can open this door if I go past 8:30, and so I'll try not to. My first feast was in 1966 in Big Sandy, Texas. I was a freshman there at Ambassador College that year. Mr. Armstrong came to speak. I recall that very bit. You know, it's your first feast, and he comes. I think he came from Jekyll Island or something that year to Big Sandy. And, of course, I always remembered him when he gave the first sermon that I ever heard him give live at a Feast of Tabernacles. And he began by asking the question, brethren, why are we here? Why are we here? Now, you've heard that many, many times, I know. Now, he did not mean by that the short answer that the Bible commands us to be here. He meant the long answer. What it pictures and teaches us about God's plan for man. It was not long into his sermon before he paused and he asked the next question. I wonder, brethren, do we really see the big picture? Well, that has always stuck with me, quite a statement that he made. And that was 52 years ago and 53 feasts ago for myself. And I know a lot of you probably have been around even longer than that. Well, we are here for 8 days to once again take a look and see what is that big picture that he referred to 52 years ago when I heard him first say that. What is the big picture? What is the big picture? By the way, you like to see a nice movie? I do. A lot of times if it's advertised on TV and it's going to be appearing, coming out in a few weeks or whatever, I like to see the preview. I like to see the trailer. And if it's really good, and sometimes it's getting more and more rare anymore, but occasionally they do have some very good ones here. I saw one here recently about the Jews and the Mossad back in 1960, how they were able to go into Argentina and capture Adolf Eichmann and take him back to Jerusalem and Israel for trial. Quite an interesting movie and showing their intelligence system and how well it was expanded and so forth at that particular time to be able to have all of their agents come in from different directions into Argentina. And they were able to capture him and get him out without the Argentine authorities even knowing about it. So I like a good movie. I like to see the trailer or the preview. Well, what is the big picture? Let me describe for you the biggest picture that will ever be made. It is big. This picture is so big that it has been in the making for the last 6,000 years. The cast is so large that even Cecil B. DeMille would be mind-boggled at its numbers. Now, who was Cecil B. DeMille? Well, back in the early 60s, you don't know. Some of the older people do. He produced the epic the Ten Commandments. And what happened after the 10th plague? A couple thousand people on the cast representing the Israelites went out as a mob out of Egypt. Not quite that way in the Bible, but that's how it was in the picture. They play it many times every year before the Easter season comes around. The planning for this picture goes back long before 6,000 years ago. The theme is the kingdom of God. The producer is God the Father. The director is Jesus Christ. This picture has been so long in the making that the producer and the director have invited a select cast in once a year to have a week-long preview to see where this picture presently is and where it is going. It is amazing. It is at this annual preview that this select cast is reminded of how big their part is in this picture. Now, just what is their part? They are being asked to play their own destiny. Right now, this select cast is just coming to see how big their part and their destiny really is. The Bible calls this cast a first fruits of those who will eventually be used to help finish the picture. This picture is so big that you will never see anything like it in any theater, or certainly not on television. Its running time would be too long. It cannot be measured in hours. It must be measured in millenniums. Every year at the annual preview, the director, Jesus Christ, shows the select cast how the picture will end. The ending is absolutely incredible. It is phenomenal because billions of human beings are resurrected from the dead to be cast in the final scenes. You can hardly believe the ending. The director takes a cast of billions of diverse people and in the final scene brings them all together as one people. You might ask, well, how can something like that ever happen? Is it a trick or some kind of magic? No, it isn't. The producer and the director have a well-thought-out plan that requires one very important thing from each member of the cast. Each member must believe in the big picture and have full confidence in the producer and the director. And if they do not, then someone else will be chosen to play their part. What is also amazing is that when the select cast comes together for the preview every year, they are more at one than at any other time of the year. Even the previews have a tremendous influence on the audience. Seeing the big picture makes all other issues and problems of life seem very small. In fact, there is nothing in life that is any more important than the big picture. This is the ultimate picture. You would never want to miss it. In fact, the preview is playing in select theaters around the world this very week. It is playing right here this week, the trailer, the preview. And I hope this year's annual preview will be inspiring and motivating for everyone. Now, since we have viewed the previews in past years, let's ask the question, how does the big picture relate to us today? Let's see what we can learn from history. Israel was given a big picture to live for and to look forward to. It wasn't as big as today's picture. Today's picture, much has developed on it. And when you look at the preview since the time of Israel in the Old Testament, how much more has been added to all of this great picture that God is working out here. Now, in Exodus chapter 19 and in verse 6, you don't have to turn, I'll just quickly read what I want to read here to you. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. The first generation failed to believe in the big picture. They were given a major role. They were going to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But because they didn't believe, then the director had to go to the second generation and use the second generation because, at least for some and for a period of time, some of them did believe, and he could use them. But unbelief canceled the role of the first generation in their part in the picture. But what about that second generation? Under Joshua's leadership, they attained most of what had been promised to the first generation. Joshua kept their minds on the big picture, and the result was that they stayed united and attained much of it, although they certainly had their sins along the way and problems, but overall, they were kept together. After conquering most of the promised land, the tabernacle with the Ark of the Covenant was moved from Gilgal on the border to Shiloh in the central highlands, which is 25 miles north of Jerusalem today. It would remain there for 300 years until the Philistines would capture the Ark of the Covenant, as recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 4 and in verse 3. But under Joshua, this is where Israel came to see the annual preview at the Feast of Tabernacles in Shiloh. And we'll look at a few scriptures here. I'm going to go to Joshua chapter 18 to start with. In Joshua 18 and in verse 1, it says, "Now the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them." And so this became the central point. Why? Because the tabernacle was there and the Ark of the Covenant was under the mercy seat in the tabernacle at that time. And they would assemble there, and as we're going to see in just a short time here, they kept a feast there for quite a long time. They saw a preview for those who believed at that time. Well, going on in Joshua 24 and verse 31, as we come to the end of the book of Joshua, just a statement here that I'd like to read, verse 31. "Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel." What is this telling us here? It tells us that under Joshua's leadership, the second generation, and now going into third and fourth as time was going by, that more people, they came to see the preview, to see the annual, the big picture that was being given to them annually. And but it would not always last that long, as I mentioned before. Now, when Israel saw and believed in the big picture, they did a good work. A good work for what they were called to do in their age and to their time. But unfortunately, that would all soon change. If we go to the book of Judges, chapter 18 of Judges, and verse 31... Judges 18 and in verse 31. "So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh." Now they're turning away. Joshua is dead. And the elders who followed him are dying off. So what are the people doing? They're losing sight of the big picture. They're going after false directors. And they are not following the true one. And so, right here in the very place where the tabernacle was in Shiloh, now they're adding other things around that tabernacle in that same area and village area. Going to chapter 21, just a couple other verses I'd like to read here in Judges. Judges 21 and in verse 19. "Then they said, in fact, there is a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel." Now, what do you think that feast was? This feast. And that's where they met. Why were they there? Because the tabernacle was there. And when they were observing and keeping it, they were seeing a portion of the big picture. Not the same picture you're seeing here today and have been for years leading up to this year. But they were seeing as much as was produced at that time, if they believed and if they would continue to come to the feast to see the preview each year of the great picture that God had in store for them. Well, it didn't last long because when you look at the bottom of the last verse of that chapter of Judges 21:25, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes." They began to turn away They did what was right in their own eyes. There's an analogy even in our modern times that you can look at when you read that verse, verse 25 there, and think about it. Back in 1994-95, when people began to turn away, you don't need to come to the feast. You don't need to see the big picture anymore. That's all in the past. And what happened? Many people went and did what was right in their own eyes, quote, in worshiping God on their terms, their way. They lost sight. And when you come to the feast every year, you come and you are reviewing and also maybe learning new things about the great picture that God the Father and Jesus Christ is developing and giving to all of us and eventually to all of mankind. Now, as you go forward from the book of Judges, about 1,000 years, you come to Nehemiah chapter 8, where they came back from the captivity, the Babylonian captivity. And here is something that I think is quite interesting to look at. Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 17 and 18. So the whole assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths. They sat under the booths. For since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, until that day the children of Israel had not done so, and there was very great gladness. And just like today, great gladness to come and to see the picture once again. 900 to 1,000 years have gone by since the time of Joshua when this is taking place. Verse 18, and day by day from first until the last day, he read from the book of the law of God. And what was in that? The picture. He's explaining the big picture. And they kept the feast 7 days. And on the eighth day, there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. Yes, quite a time. After the captivity, they're coming back. Now they're keeping and seeing the picture once again. And Ezra is reading to them and explaining it from the book of the law which they had at that time. Now, we have much more today. That's true. More has been added to the picture. It's an ongoing, it's a work in progress that God is carrying out. The big picture requires faith, which includes obedience, and the result is unity in doing the producer and the director's work. But you may say, theirs was a different picture for a different time. They were different people, and it was a far different time than we live in today. And I would agree, it certainly is. Well, let's look at something that is very close to our time today, maybe. I have a book entitled The History of the Seventh-day Church of God by a man named Richard Nichols. It's well-researched, has extensive footnotes in every chapter. Quite interesting reading. The Church of God in the 19th century was very scattered and fragmented. One of its biggest trials was its separation from the Adventist movement in the early 1860s. Each congregation was autonomous at that time. There was no central leadership and virtually no work being done. They understood most of the doctrines that you and I believe, but they did not believe in the annual preview of the big picture. For almost 60 years, they did very little work. In 1914, Andrew N. Duggar became leader of the Church of God and editor of the magazine, The Bible Advocate. The study of prophecy began to stir them towards doing a work. I'd like to read a little bit here from the page 56 of this book. One of the main influences upon A.N. Duggar was his father's teaching that there would be a world war in 1912 to 1914. This was based upon his understanding of Bible prophecies concerning a 2,520-year period. Based upon the seven times punishment prophecy of Leviticus 26 and the overturn of Ezekiel 21, verses 25 through 27. That's in the King James Version, by the way. You don't see too many versions today that will quote it that way. Duggar concluded that, quote, as it required three successive strokes in the destruction of the kingdom of Israel by the overturning three times by Nebuchadnezzar, So it is to require three strokes for the destruction of all Gentile nations, that is, three world wars. Quite interesting how they were that far back in time and how they were thinking and as they were coming into the 20th century. They organized, of course, this was 1914, but they organized the tithe system so that they could begin to do a work which began in 1922. That's interesting going on here. When A.M. Duggar took over the editorship of The Advocate in 1914, World War I was beginning, and soon the way was opened for the Jews to return to Palestine. These prophecies which the Church of God had taught were being fulfilled. This seems to have been an impetus for the year 1914, marking, quote, a decided awakening in the church. It marked the beginning of an explosion of missionary work performed by the Church of God in the years after the Great War and into the Roaring Twenties. Quite interesting reading a lot of things you probably weren't aware of that were going on at that particular time. The problem was it did not last very long. One last one that I would like to read here, quote that is, another paragraph. By 1923, the big push, quote unquote, was going at full gallop. The Messenger, their paper, reported on January 16th that in the past month, some 41,888 pages of free literature had been distributed. Arrangements were being made to print Church of God literature in Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, German, Spanish, and Chinese, as well as two of the languages of India. Duggar reported that, quote, $100,000 could be quickly used to great benefit in swiftly spreading the last message, end of quote. Urgent calls for literature were coming in from all over the world. Duggar felt that Matthew 24, verse 14, this gospel will be preached in all the world and then the end shall come, was being fulfilled, that Jesus would not come until the gospel of the kingdom went to every nation and people of all languages entered the church of God. This, he believed, would take several years yet, end of quote there. What happened? Well, at the time of, in 1933, the Church of God Seventh Day split over organization and control. At the time of the split, there was a little known elder from Oregon named Herbert Armstrong who believed in something that Andrew Duggar rejected, the annual holy days. Herbert Armstrong succeeded where those before him failed because he saw the big picture. And what's more, he believed it. The annual preview was restored to the church, and the church saw and believed the big picture. So how does the big picture relate to us today as we come into the 21st century? The big picture points us in the right direction and the true purpose of our calling. It assures us of a clear view of what the producer and the director have stored in store for all of us. It also assures us of the very important role that we will play in the eternal picture. And that's what it is, an eternal picture. Something we have now come here to see for the following 8 days while we are here. So let's get a good night's rest, brethren. And let's come tomorrow prepared to see an 8-day preview of the greatest picture that will ever be made.